This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
I'm just saying, it ain't every day I get to have a conversation with the left, and to do it in a place like Chicago with such a long legacy of resistance is no small thing. My ancestors and elders would have killed for an opportunity to sit with thousands of people who are not scared to come to a conference named Socialism. Great. So I'm gonna need us to have that energy today. That's what time it is at this panel. But you know, before I start preaching, I want to see who's in the room. It's about y'all just as much as it is these really brilliant and beautiful people that are up in the front. So if you are like from the West Coast, can I get a whoop whoop? All right. Y'all always stay lit. If you are from the Pacific Northwest, where you at? Okay, I see y'all. Listen, that's my stepsister of the South is the Pacific Northwest. I see you. Y'all see I'm saving the best for last. If you are from the Northeast, I always expect New Yorkers to come with more energy than that, but I'm going to let y'all live. I say, you got to go. Wop, wop, wop. If you're from the Global South, can you say what's up? Okay, I love you. I see you. And I see you. And if you are from what I would argue is the belly of the beast, if you are a dangerous homosexual of the South or just from the legacy of the South, can I get a woo woo? Gang, 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 gang. All right. If you are transplants, we love you. Y'all all Southern, you just don't know it yet. If you are coming very excited and optimistic, let's split these things up. If you are coming very optimistic about our power to build the left in this country and its impact on the world, wave at me. That's dope as fuck. That's not what I expected. I see you. If you are coming skeptical and maybe even raging about the inadequacy of the left, can you wave at me? Yeah. Yeah. If you're coming like, oh, I feel totally clear about what must be done in this moment, wave at me. And if you're coming with a whole hell of a lot of questions, wave at me. Yeah, I just want to start by saying, one, look at who's in the room. Look at each other. Like, I know you want to look at us, but, like, look at each other. I'm going to do that one more time. If you are coming because you are wanting to be in conversation with comrades about maybe what we could do in a way that doesn't do what the opposition wants us to do and fragment versus being unified, wave at each other. That's what this panel is about. So I just want you to see who's in the room and that there's more of us than people that are just trying to be in fake-ass fights with other leftists. Okay. Oh, I didn't say the Midwest. My bad, y'all. Shout out to the Midwest. Shout out to the Midwest. My bad. Thank you, whoever you were, for calling me in. You were right. Thank you. I appreciate that because I'm wrong 20 times a day. So let's talk a little bit really quickly about some of the goal for today, and you already heard my comrade speak to some of it. One is that I don't know, and I could have missed it because there's a lot of program, but I don't know of anything else on the program where three explicit socialist organizations are coming together across our differences and at our points of unity to talk to one another and to share with others about what we think is going on, right? So I just want to say, like, shout out to Liberation Road and DSA and North Star for having the impetus to be protagonists and say, like, actually, we're going to show people that there can be a unified conversation between the left. So the goal is to do that and to be in dialogue with one another, both the folks that are up here, but also we're putting y'all to work. So you enjoy this me talking at you for a little bit and us talking at you for a little bit, because then y'all got to talk. I'm warning you. That's your warning that you are going to actually have to talk. And then again, just to ground us in some of the goal of why we're here is like, again, there are these intensifying contradictions that are giving us a whole bunch of bad choices to have to choose between. And the white Christian nationalist right is organizing for and frankly winning power every day. The neo-fascist MAGA movement is not the same old right wing that we've been used to, right? So what we have to do is figure out how we can come together across our differences on the front lines, and we have to discuss strategy and tactics, which are not the same things, for today's fight right here in the United States in the time, place, and conditions that we've inherited and, frankly, some of the conditions that we've created. Now I want to set some norms. I think I've already started. I think you're already feeling the norms that I think we're going to be doing. We can disagree, but we are not going to be ugly with each other in this space, okay? If you can agree to that, can you wave at me? Right, we're trying to build the left. We're not trying to fragment the left, okay? We can disagree. We can be disagreeable. There can be hard lines around our disagreement. But what we are not going to do is disrespect each other and come expecting that our intentions are not for the sake of our people, okay? We also aren't going to answer every question in this, like, less than an hour that we've got together, okay? But we promise that there's going to be avenues for you to continue to engage with each of our organizations and where our organizations come together, okay? So I just want to set up a norm that we will be curious, that we will be an invitation to being in our fullest dignity, that we will be proud without being perfect, okay? Can we do that? Yeah. All right. Well, then y'all also know, I did used to work at Highlander. Shout out to the team. Woo. I think there's some Highlander staff in the building. So shout out to y'all. That's the gang. And you know that I don't believe in doing anything without some sort of culture, right? We got to set the culture. North Star, we believe culture is a weapon. And if you don't know how to wield it, then you're wasting a tactic, right? So I'm going to ask everybody who's willing and able to please rise with me. And I'm going to teach some of y'all probably know it, a song that we sing at Highlander all the time. And I'm going to take this mask off because I can't breathe. And I'm going to teach you this song. And we're also potentially going to use the song as your cue to come back to the large group later, okay? So when we do our breakouts, if you hear me sing this, it's a call and response. I want you to start singing it, and I want you to start making your way back to the full group. Got it? Do you have it? Okay, cool. So it's a call and response, super easy. The words are solid as a rock, rooted like a tree. We are here, standing strong in our rightful place. Well, Ashley, why would you want us to sing a song called Solid as a Rock? Well, I want you to be solid as a rock. I want you to be rooted like a tree. I want you to be grounded in your assessments and your actions. I want you to know that we are here, collective. That's something to celebrate. I want you to know that we are strong because I don't want to be following no powerless people, right? And that we're in our rightful place. We actually have the right to be here just by the fact of being here, right? Being born, being present. So solid as a rock. Rooted like a tree. We are here, standing strong in our rightful place. Now, I'm going to teach you how to sing it. And if you don't sing it like you believe it, you're wasting our time. You are unserious. If you can't prove it to me that you believe those words, then I promise you, you won't be able to make capitalists believe it. Right? And even more importantly, you won't be able to get the base of the working class people that you say you represent to believe it. Right? So I'm going to ask you to do it like you want to win, okay? All right. Solid as a rock.
Solid as a rock.
Rooted like a tree.
Rooted like a tree.
We are here.
We are here.
Standing strong.
Standing strong.
In a rightful place.
In a rightful place.
Okay, you got it?
Yeah.
Okay, so now can we sing it like we're not practicing?
Yeah.
All right, so if you like need to shake it out real quick because you're like, I don't do that singing shit, it makes me uncomfortable. Get it out, get it out, get it out. It's me too, I get it. I don't sing in public. I do this because I get paid to. All right, y'all ready?
Yeah.
Solid as a rock.
Solid as a rock.
We are rooted like a tree.
We are rooted like a tree.
We are here.
We are here.
Standing strong.
Standing strong.
In our rightful place.
In our rightful place.
We are solid as a rock.
We are rooted like a tree.
We are here.
We are here.
Standing strong.
Standing strong.
In our rightful place.
In our rightful place.
One more time. We are solid as a rock. We are rooted like a tree. We are here, standing strong in our rightful place. In our rightful place. In our rightful place. Rightful place. I love you. Sit down.
Woo! Thank you. And with that, we want to get into some context and some history. Where are we today? The first question I have is, in our panel notes, we state, today's neo-fascist MAGA movement is not the same old right wing of capitalist consensus. So what is different today? What is today's MAGA right, and why do we call them neo-fascist? To start us off, I'm going to turn it over to Bennett.
For folks who didn't hear that, the hands raised are folks with an empty seat next to them. So if you are standing and want to be sitting, look for a hand. I think we've got one seat left. Two seats left, three, four. I feel like an auctioneer. So last chance for anyone to grab a seat.
And there's seats on the edge here. If you want to come sit in the front, that's no sweat.
All right, thanks, y'all. Thanks for taking care of each other. I'm going to try and do three things as quickly as I can. One is give a little bit of trace some lineage of what is today's MAGA right from about 1965 through Project 2025, quickly. Two is explain why is today's MAGA right different? Where are the continuities, but how is it different from the right wing of the late 20th century and the neoliberal consensus? And three, why should we call it fascist or neo-fascist or post-fascist? I'm not gonna quibble about the term. Okay. So I want to start this story in really 1964 with the Goldwater campaign and its aftermath and the emergence of a new right, what gets called a new right. And this new right is coming to be in reaction and response to the victories won by our movements across the 20th century. First and foremost in that moment, the tremendous victories of the civil rights movement. Even earlier, the victories of the workers' movement in the 30s, 40s, and beyond. And a little bit later, the victories of the women's liberation movement, the gay liberation movement, other liberation movements that are really starting by the 60s, 70s to fundamentally scare the ruling class of this country. In a deep way, they start to realize people are empowered, and we're losing our power, and we've got to do something about it. And there's a section of the capitalist elite who feel like the conservative party of that time is not doing enough, is not aggressive enough in pushing back against those movements, in pushing back against democracy. And it says we need to do something, right? And you know, this is Joe Kors from the Kors Fortune. This is eventually the Koch brothers, various intellectual kind of libertarian luminaries. But they have a problem, which is that their agenda is not very popular. Saying we want to push back against most people and protect the privilege of the wealthy few isn't, on the surface, a winning agenda. And so what they do is they start to build these alliances with sections of white, Christian, evangelical Protestants, right, who are also terrified by the victories of the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, the women's movement, but for different reasons. You know, they're terrified of it because fundamentally this is challenging white, patriarchal, Christian nationalism, right? And these are different reasons, but there's enough overlap between them that they can start to form an alliance, which, by the way, from the beginning is not just a racial backlash, it is, but is also very much a gender backlash, thinking that, you know, some of the first social movements of that new right are the fight against busing integration, but also the anti-abortion fights that start to intensify in the 1970s. Let's see. Okay, so that's where we start. In that time period, this project cannot explicitly say our goal is to suppress the victories of these movements. And so what it does is take on kind of the guise of an ideology that we now know as neoliberalism, right? Which is an attempt to restore those class, racial, and gender hierarchies, but in a sort of covert way around an ideology defined by really three key points. Individualism, free markets, so deregulation, et cetera, and quote-unquote small government, meaning we're going to shrink all parts of the capitalist state that do anything other than perpetuate the conditions of class rule. So we're going to keep the military, we're going to keep the courts, but we're going to try and get rid of everything else. And none of this is explicitly saying we're trying to suppress people, right? It's framed as a project that will free people, in fact. But its goal is to really restore those systems of power and privilege for the vast majority of the population, while at the same time allowing the selective entrance of some people of color, some women, some gay people, into the elite, both the capitalist class, but especially the small business owners, professional managerial classes, cultural elites, politicians, right, in ways that kind of hides the nature of what's going on. Olufemi Taiwo has called this woke racial capitalism. It kind of preserves the probabilistic nexus between how, you know, what identities you're born with and where you're going to end up, but diversifies things at the top. And I don't mean to diminish their partial gains, but the real gains that that brings. Okay, so fast forward to the 2000s, and especially post-2008, and we start to see the contradictory fruits of this project. On the one hand, particularly after the 2008 economic crisis, but building on 40 years of neoliberal economic policy that have devastated ordinary people, you start to see real rage, not just from the left, but from the base of the right as well, against growing inequality, against growing dispossession, right? And simultaneously, for sections of their base, you see growing rage against the way that that connects to this selective diversification of the people they see in positions of power and privilege. Both whether we think about Obama as the first black president, whether we think about RuPaul suddenly being on your TV screen in middle America, the horror, right? And so it intensifies, love you, RuPaul. you know, it intensifies the and radicalizes a certain sector of white Christian evangelical Protestants into a much more explicitly white Christian nationalist movement, starting with the Tea Party, but again, this has longer origins, up through and kind of culminating in 2016. So one point I want to, you know, I think we're all clear on is Trump is not the origin of these processes, right? But 2016 catalyzes them. And it catalyzes them because for the first time, those white Christian nationalists who were the junior partner in the right-wing bloc under neoliberalism actually seize control. The neoliberal capitalist contingent are not steering the ship anymore. It's now the radicalized white Christian nationalist right alongside formerly fringe far-right and neo-Nazi elements who are really steering the ship and who consolidate their control over both the Republican Party, but also the broader conservative apparatuses over these next 8 years, bringing us to today. So while this is a continuity on one hand with neoliberalism insofar as it emerges out of it, it's a fundamentally different project. It's led by a different set of forces, and its ideology starts to shift. Neoliberalism is no longer the dominant ideology in either political party in this country. And it has, what we are in is a fight for what will replace it. But if you look at Project 2025, you will find, incredibly, no references to slashing government spending. You'll find no references to slashing Social Security or Medicaid or benefits. They are willing to throw out significant portions of that ideology of individualism, small government, free markets of the last 30, 40 years. And then simultaneously, the patriarchal, anti-LGBTQ, anti-immigrant, anti-people of color components of that ideology that had been implicit are now becoming explicit, right? So why call this fascist? I mean, there's a lot we can say. I hope we can get into some more of it in the kind of discussion, both on the panel and with y'all. But in short, you know, one, it just bears all the characteristics of fascism, whether we think about the suppression of opposition, the demonization of opposition, centralized autocracy, militarism, the deep entwinement of government and religion. I mean, if you take one look at Project 2025, it is very explicitly a Christian supremacist text. On an economic level, we see the jettisoning of some aspects of free trade policies, et cetera, in favor of a sort of dirigiste economic policy with stronger state intervention oriented towards protectionism and national self-sufficiency, this sort of America First model, which again has parallels with most fascist regimes historically. Two other things I'll say briefly that I hope we can come back to that are, I think, important components of what makes this project fascist. One is the attempt to suppress gender and sexual deviance and impose a particular vision of the patriarchal family. This has always been part of the fascist project. It's happening in this moment. Trans communities are the front line on which this battle is being fought. And I say that here because I am very worried that the left has not understood that trans rights are not, in this moment, a secondary issue. It is the central struggle around which they're trying to win power, right? Because they perceive it as the weak link in the chain. Abortion, is popular. They're scared now. You know, gay marriage, popular. They're trying to figure out where can we get that wedge that they can get in, and we need to keep them out. Second kind of social issue component, or second component that makes it a fascist project, I would say, is the split between people who are considered deserving of human rights and others who are considered undeserving, alien to the body politic, and in some sense, because of that, not fully human. This has always been part of the fascist project. It takes different forms. In this moment, I would argue that just like trans folks are the tip of the spear on a broader assault on many people of oppressed genders, attacks on immigrants and immigration, I think, is functioning the same way when it comes to the sort of dehumanization of a part of the population. This is a genocidal project in both cases that we need to take very seriously. The last thing I'll say is that makes this fascist is it's no longer a conservative force in the sense that MAGA is not trying to conserve anything. They are fundamentally trying to overthrow the existing structure and replace it with something different. We need to grapple with that. We need to understand it. And we need to take seriously when the president of the Heritage Foundation says, this is the second American revolution that we are trying to carry out, and it will be bloodless if the left lets it be. We need to take them very much seriously at their word and understand that the MAGA right is now a revolutionary force for fascism that we need to oppose and defeat. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bennett. So let's get into what is in front of us. Ashley, will you tell us a little bit about Project 2025?
How many people have been like obsessively reading it over and over and over? It's not just me? Okay. All right, good. Okay. So I'm probably not going to tell you anything that you don't already know. One, just thank you, Bennett, for sort of grounding us in honestly what is a most contemporary history of the fascist and authoritarian rise of the right in this country. If you're a nerd and you want to go back even further than the 20th century, you know, I know some of you in the room might have big critiques of Rachel Maddow, and you're right, but even a broken clock is right twice a day. And she has done a podcast and written a book, but the podcast is called Ultra, and I strongly recommend you listen. Not only does it just re-edify a lot of what Bennett just taught, but also talks about even before the 50s and 60s, how armed right-wing militias have been fighting for governing power in this country and the anti-Semitic roots of it. So I strongly encourage you to listen to it. So Project 2025, if you had to just shout out in a word what it is and how it makes you feel, what would it be?
Terrifying.
Keep going. Fascist, vomit, yes. All of those things and some, right? Fearful, Neanderthal, I hear you, but they spend a lot of money and it's pretty smart. It's accessory to murder, absolutely. Authoritarian, it's conspiracy, it's all the things, right? So let's just start with like literally what it is, okay? It's four pillars, very broad. There's a playbook, I'm using their language. It's a playbook, it's policy, right? They're talking about laws. It's personnel, right? They are building essentially a mass org of people that could immediately be hired to execute the playbook and get the policy, right? So all these things are connected. They're not just four segregated pillars. And the last is training, right? They're not only going to popularize the playbook, the policy, and get the personnel set up. They're also going to train not only the personnel, but as many people as they can get their hands on, right? It's been leaked. Y'all saw the hack, and now the training is now like out on YouTube and anybody can watch it. That's so convenient, right? So there are four broad pillars. Playbook, say playbook. Policy. Personnel. And training. So it's a systemic, like systematic, comprehensive plan. It was, do y'all know who is getting all the credit for having developed it? The Heritage Foundation. What's the Heritage Foundation? Big money group, private industry, conservative, Reagan administration timeline. It's a think tank, right? And, you know, when it first came out, like in the very, very earliest incarnation of their website, it was like 70 organizations. If you go now, it's like 80 organizations, like 90, like people are joining into the plan, right? And a lot of the folks that were involved in the earliest days in that 70 group include people that I'm sure y'all are probably fighting on the front lines every day. Anybody doing education justice work in the room? A couple of folks. So y'all know Moms for Liberty? They all up in the mix, right? It's social organizations. It's identity-based organizations. Some of them are like Christian nationalists. Some of them are secular. Some of them are, you know, think tanks like the Heritage Foundation. Some of them are philanthropists and foundations. Y'all know, like, we're not the only people that have foundations, right? The right also has foundations and individual donors. And so that's some of who they are. There's also, like, former Trump officials, like Trump administration officials. Any labor heads in the room? A couple of y'all. Y'all real quiet labor. I'm a little surprised. So folks that are in the labor movement might remember the Trump administration official who like made it hard to get like paid for overtime and like did like helped move policy that allowed for multinational corporations like McDonald's, for example, to actually screw over the workers and blame it on the franchisees and not take any corporate responsibilities for what they were allowing to happen to their workers. The guy that was doing that wrote the labor chapter in Project 2025. So former Trump administration officials, and then just like his homies from the MAGA movement, all came together across their difference to build a faction that could move, right? Its pretty sole purpose is to consolidate executive power, right? So when you hear people talk about Project 2025 and they're like, they want to give Trump all the power, that's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. And not because they actually care about him, but because having him as their puppet, their figurehead, allows for them to move into those administrative bodies and then wreak havoc. I'm going to say some stuff that might sound a little bit about like a little bit like what we hear from some of our own comrades, right? These folks are like, the government is broken. It doesn't work for you. Yeah, that sound familiar? Y'all ain't never said that. The government is trash. It doesn't work for you. And so we need to get in there and we need to just take it down, right? That's essentially what Project 2025 is saying they're going to do. When it's in act, basically what they're going to do is concentrate and consolidate that executive power and then deploy a network of very loyal, I mean like loyalty tested, like oath given personnel for the next administration. And they already have the list of the folks that they would hire. And they're already training those people to execute Project 2025. Make sense? Scared to death, right? And then when they enact it, this plan is fundamentally going to undermine basic government resources and like, again, we would agree to some degree that the government doesn't do everything it needs to be doing to support our people, right? I'm not arguing that, right? I just also want you to be careful about when you use right-wing talking points without a plan, okay? The reason why this matters to I think the strategic left, not the unstrategic left, I'm not trying to convince y'all if you're in the room, but for the strategic left, is that the plan is going to undermine the basic government resources and programs that right now, today, support women's health, that support like all of our fight for climate justice. We'll at least say the environment. Let's at least that. It's at least doing that around the very minimal impact that we've been able to have about justice and voting the economy, education, any immigrant justice folks in the room, we've been getting our teeth knocked in, but the little bit that we got was because of some of the people that we had in position in the government that will no longer be there if Project 2025 is enacted. It'll impact foreign policy and other areas of concern to people like us. And I don't want you to get it twisted. That's always been the right's overall governing strategy. They've always wanted to build this level of power. This is not new. They just now have operationalized a plan that won't go away. Well, one, Southerners, wave at me again. Hi, you're already kind of living Project 2025. Well, I see you. And for folks that don't live in the South, it won't just go away and still just be the problem of those of us that live in the South and Pacific Northwest if Trump doesn't win this time. The plan now exists. It's public and disseminated. Their ability to execute it is now forever going to be our challenge. Okay? So it's not new. It's just consolidated. And when they execute this move, it will implement long-term implications for us. It will implicate our ability to build state power on the state level, right? Because I know there's some folks that are like, oh, well, fuck the feds. We'll just go local. But I can tell you again, as a Southerner, that preemption is real. So your ability to build state power will be explicitly implicated because of Project 2025. And it went from being like a guinea pig project on some of us that are, you know, suffering the most in this country to now being something that's going to confront you regardless of your level of privilege. So if I'm going to tell you, I'm going to close it up because I know I'm at time. For folks that actually for real want to be in a practice of study about this, I'm going to give you some tools. Okay, so if you're taking notes, this is where you get ready. And I'm going to tell you these tools not because I want you to go and be an evangelical for Project 2025. That serves no one. For all of us that got obsessed and then were like, read Project 2025. This is Project 2025. Know everything that's in it, but haven't told people what to do about it. We failed. Okay? So I'm not telling you this just so you go regurgitate your trauma all over everybody else in your base. I'm telling you this so that you can then use these tools that I'm about to give you to be like, this is the stuff we care about and this is what we should do to stop it. Okay? Not just to tell people what's in it. Got me? So if I give you these tools, will you please not just go scare the shit out of people without telling them what to do? Thank you. So the first website I'm going to give you is whatisproject2025.net. If you just don't really still understand what's in it and you don't want to go on the project, please don't go to the Project 2025 website and keep giving them hits, right? Go to whatisproject2025.net. It has a whole tab so that you can understand the plan and its purpose. It has a download of the plan, so if you want to read it in its entirety, you could. And then it helps break down the stakes and the impact. They have a whole analysis of that. Okay, so what is project2025.net? The second website I'm going to give you is defeatproject2025.org. Defeatproject2025.org. It does some of the similar things of breaking down what's in the plan. But what I like about this website is that it also goes policy for policy by the issue that you care about. So if you want to be like, what is the impact on labor? What is the impact on climate? What is the impact on reproductive justice? Whatever the issue, you can see what policies across the chapters are going to impact your base and make a plan, right? The third that I want to give you is stopthecoup2025.org, because y'all know even if we win the popular vote, they're going to steal it, right? Yeah, they're trying to steal it, right? Y'all know that, right? So Stop the Coup is a multi-organization coalition of folks that were like, we've got to start figuring out something about what we're going to do. It has all sorts of resources. There's a tab called How Will It Affect Me that is also something that I use to understand what the implications of the policies in this are going to be. And then last but certainly not, well, actually, two more. One is called 25 and, so 25 the number and the word spelled out, .me. 25andme.me. And if you click that, it's a really boring looking website. It's like a blank page with really regular ass script. And if you press the I care about, it will take you to the issues and break it down. And the folks that have pulled this together are some of the smartest people on the inside that are trying to give us intel about what's coming and how it will impact our communities, but also how it'll impact like the folks that are still on the inside of the administration. Last but certainly not least, if you want more details around some of the strategies that folks are executing to do something about it, There's multiple YouTube videos that you can watch from both Highlander and some of our partners. So I through Highlander with Linda Burnham, who we all love and respect, Right to the City, and Ajaris Dixon did a whole series on fascism called Fascism 101. Did anybody watch it? Yeah, so all of that is on Highlander's Vimeo. And then you can also see what many folks are trying to do from the front lines, and some connected to political parties like the Working Families Party are trying to do to block MAGA and build what we need. You can do that if you take your phone and you text mass call, two words, to 30403. You can get access to all those recordings. You don't even have to do that. You can go to WFP's YouTube page and see all of the mass calls that we've done since April that are talking about Project 2025 and what we intend to do about it from a cross sector. So I don't want to minimize Project 2025. I want you to know what's in it. We should be scared. It's terrifying. But if we only know what's in it and don't have a plan to, one, prevent it from going any further forever, and also to fix what it's already doing in places where people are suffering the most in this country, we will have failed.
Thank you, Ashley. So, Renee, for you, I have kind of our bridging question into the next section, but what has the fight against fascism looked like historically?
Hi, everyone. So I think for me in evaluating the question, which is, I think also includes the question of how it's different, you know, in this iteration, and, you know, whether you're looking at the struggles in Europe against fascist movements in those countries, or if you're considering sort of the global war on fascism that World War II was, or even if you go back to our own earlier history and look at the Civil War and the fight against the Confederacy, I think that comparatively the left is at a much lower ebb of power within the popular front, so to speak, and I think that real low level of power leads to an unfortunate like nihilism wherein we're not going to, you know, have even a Lincoln or Roosevelt at the head of this fight. We have, you know, a former prosecutor who, I mean, I litigated cases against her office. She gives me rage blindness. You know, the interview on Palestine, like it's so upsetting that this is, you know, where we are, but our being upset about that won't change the position of the left, and it won't change the necessity of defeating the enemy. And I think that, I think that you know, in my own organizing, I think that people often see actually trying to contest for power within the popular front, within the, you know, group of forces who are arrayed against this, it's complicated, it's messy, it's not binary, and it doesn't feel morally righteous in the same way that line drawing can. And I get it. I mean, we're all leftists. We understand how fun it is to denounce things and people. It's fun. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't make up, I think, for winning and holding power to make everyone's lives better. And, you know, when I look back at those historical moments, you have an actual, you know, popular front in these places where the left wing has more power. And then in all three sort of post-struggle settlements, you see the left losing out. And so I think, you know, people say, well, therefore, in this moment, why would we go back in and do this again and again, get shut out? And I think the answer to me is, as the Democratic Party deals with the post-Bernie moment of, you know, who are we now? You know, when you had 2016, when you had this struggle between the right and left in the party, when you had the Bernie wing ultimately in some ways, you know, getting, you know, this convention domestically was so vastly different than prior ones, right? Like the party has moved left on some of these issues. If we as the left of the left absent ourselves from that particular struggle, we're not going to be listened to in the post-struggle settlement. So anyway, I apologize for that being a little bit stream of consciousness, but it's been every day is changing these questions, right? So anyway, with that, I'll stop running at the mouth and send it back to my Kiko.
You're going
to
continue. I'm waiting you first on this. So given that, all three of our organizations embrace something like an inside-outside orientation to both electoral politics broadly and the centrist Democratic Party establishment narrowly. What does that look like for each of the organizations and your organizing concretely? And how do these tasks change in blue, red, and purple contexts, depending on the strength and weaknesses of MAGA forces on the ground? So Renee, we're going to start with you, the work of Socialist Majority and blue context.
Yeah, so Socialist Majority is a caucus inside of DSA, and we are not representing ourselves as DSA on this panel, but instead Socialist Majority. So if you're in DSA, please don't yell at me for that. And the caucus has the largest sort of set of people in the caucus, and the one, you know, the founding of it, and now a really large set of folks are people who are involved with the New York City DSA electoral project. So I'm sort of going to focus on that as the example. And you know, New York, I think one of the reasons that New York City DSA has done so well is not just that it's, you know, sort of a very big blue left city, but also that the Democratic primaries in New York are closed. They're closed to a degree that only three or four other states have, which is that you have to change your party registration 3 months before the primary election. And as a result of that, and the fact that New York is essentially Mississippi when it comes to election administration, the turnout in those primaries is very low. In fact, AOC's primary that she won, they were holding the congressional primaries in June and all the rest of the primaries in September. So the turnout was even lower. And the reason they were held at two separate times is that the New York state elections people could not get the absentee ballots out to military voters in time for federal elections if they had the primary in September. So they got taken to court, and a federal court ordered them to hold the federal primary in June. And they moved to just the federal primary, and they never passed a law to change it. So you would get the election calendar and have a footnote and say, by court order in June. This was the state of affairs for 10 years. AOC wins her election. The next year, they move the federal primaries and the state primaries consolidated in June. So the way to get New York election law reform is to win an election against them taking advantage of the bad thing. All of which is to say, it is a very explicit, easy way of doing things, because you have this really tight choke point around the Democratic Party primary. And if you win it, then often you're on the ballot in the fall without even any Republican opponent, because it's New York City. And so choosing districts where you can win a majority of the Democratic Party primary voters with a socialist candidate, and then in the general taking the seat, and then they become part of the Democratic Party. They're not those people who pick off incumbents, you know, they're still always party outsiders, but they're often, like Hakeem Jeffries did robocalls for both Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush, even though they're from the wing of the party that opposes him, because once they're incumbents, they're in the room, right? So all of which is to say, that's how the NYC DSA electoral model came about, which is we can elect socialists by running them in Democratic Party primaries, and then they'll win the general election. We could do this on the Democratic Party ballot line following the Bernie model. And New York City DSA and other states where they've replicated or built up that success at the same time, there's this balance between being oppositional to the Democratic Party in primaries and trying to run against them as insurgent candidates, while at the same time being enough of a Democrat to sort of be able to govern, right? Because the biggest issue there is that difference between what your rhetoric looks like when you're running for office and then how you're governing. You know, in DSA, there's a lot of discussion, discourse around candidate accountability and the idea that, you know, the candidates need to be accountable to us as an organization. But in order to get reelected, they also need to be accountable to their constituents, right? They need to govern. They need, you know, one of the reasons that AOC and Rashida are both really hard to primary is they both have incredible constituent services offices. Like, if you make sure that the, you know, trash is taken away on time, like, you'll get reelected, right? Like, that's the Obviously, it's a different, it's not under federal jurisdiction yet, but that's sort of the model that's worked. And I think that it's really important to understand how much, like how difficult that is to navigate in that way. You know, one of the things that my comrade Sam Lewis always talks about is that when Julia Salazar first got elected to the state Senate, when she would go eat in the cafeteria, nobody else would sit at her table because she was an open socialist, right? Like that was the literal level of opposition that they're dealing with in those moments. All of which is to say that this is, it's a necessarily going to be a negotiation between those two positions. That's the way we look at it, that there's no way to make an easy call. Like everything is always going to be negotiated. Everything is always going to have to be contingent because we're not playing a simple game. We're trying to do this. It's complicated, but we'd rather try than absent ourselves from the arena.
Thank you, Renee. Bennett, let's talk a little bit about Liberation Road's strategy and tactics, and then also if you want to give some context around purple states.
Yeah, thanks, y'all. Liberation Road draws on a number of revolutionary lineages. We're not a particular ism, but one of those is Maoism, and I mention that because a concept of his that we have found really useful is that of the principal contradiction. And what that means is we understand that fundamentally the core contradiction of our capitalist society is capitalism. It's the contradiction between labor and capital, which itself generates and is part of a whole broader set of social contradictions that exist in relationship to each other. The kind of Mao's insight was in any one political moment, based on time, place, and conditions, one of those contradictions is going to be the principal one, meaning it is the one that has to be addressed in order to advance to the next stage of struggle. And he came to that realization in the context of the Japanese imperialist invasion of China, which already the Chinese communists and the Kuomintang had been fighting, right, between the bourgeois and the proletarian and peasant forces. The Japanese invade, and suddenly these enemies find themselves having to form a temporary and tactical alliance against a common enemy, because if they keep fighting each other, they're going to be wiped out by the Japanese. And so in that moment, the principal contradiction is with the imperial invaders. The moment that they successfully resolve that contradiction and repel the Japanese, hey, different contradiction. I say all that because we believe that in this moment, the principal contradiction in the United States is between these neo-fascist forces and everyone we can bring together to unite and defeat them, right? And that means that other contradictions we have, including with the centrist democratic establishment, exist. They are real. If we are successful in our shared battle to defeat MAGA, not just in November, but so decisively that they are no longer the biggest threat to what we have, those will break out into even more open struggles. But in this moment, we have to understand that while we continue to struggle with and against the centrist democratic establishment, we nevertheless have to work with them at times against our common enemy, right? Because just like in the Chinese example, neither of us on our own are actually powerful enough to defeat MAGA. And often I think on the left, we have a tendency either to overestimate our power and think we're this close to revolution tomorrow, or to underestimate our power and be like, well, it doesn't matter if we endorse and engage in this election or not, because nothing we could do is going to make a difference. The Democrats have got it. Y'all, I don't know why you have that much faith in the Democratic Party's ability to mobilize voters and win elections. Let me tell you, I've been inside the rooms where those plans are made. You should not have that faith. They need us too. They need our movements. They need our expertise. They need our knowledge of our people. They can't win without us when we're talking about this fight against MAGA. Yeah. So we have to be pursuing this complicated thing of struggling within as part of a broader front that we're part of. Yeah. Two other concepts we take from Mao. One is united front, which means let's bring together the broadest coalition we can against the narrowest enemy. The other is mass line, which is to say, how in doing that can we be working within the confused and contradictory ideas of our people, pulling out the correct ideas that are there, condensing them into something that we can bring back to our folks to shift the balance of power left. And so I say that because when we're engaging within electoral politics on the two-party line, we're constantly thinking, how are we fighting to advance and change the conditions such that we're not leading now, but how can we get our line to lead? How can we get our ideas at the front? How can we get our strategy, our tactics, to be the ones that are actually leading these fights, right? Which in some ways, we're seeing places where we're starting to do that. The Green New Deal suddenly became, you know, to everyone's surprise, something that the Biden administration was behind, right? So there's ways that we can start to contest that. In terms of how that looks differently in red, blue, purple context, basically, there's places where our front is on the offensive against MAGA and as one power. In those blue contexts, the struggles within the front, the secondary struggles, are around how to govern. And Renee talked about that. In places where MAGA forces have already won, the secondary struggles we might have with the Democratic Party establishment are how do we defend against our people? What does that defense look like? And differences about the strategy to do that. And I think Ash is going to touch on that. In purple state contexts like North Carolina, those secondary struggles are really about what's the best way to win elections and defeat MAGA in terms of what's the best messaging to have on the doors. Do we do this sort of centrist, depoliticized messaging to try not to offend anyone? Or do we actually try and have a bold, exciting message that will rally our people? Who are the voters we need to talk to? How do we need to do it? These are the real concrete struggles that play out and that we have to engage within. In terms of how Liberation Road does it, we have long called for the building of independent political organization using this inside-outside strategy, that basically the Democratic Party ballot line is just that, it's a ballot line. So how do we build mass membership-based democratic organizations that can run candidates on that ballot line while building power for the long term and connecting that to issue-based fights? Unlike our comrades in DSA, for whom, like, they are, like, that is the IPO. Our folks work, we're a cadre socialist organization, and we work in concentrations inside independent political organizations. So we send folks out to resource those organizations, to strengthen them, and in many cases to help build them in places where they aren't. We also have strong concentrations of folks working in social movements and in labor, particularly for folks in both contexts. Come talk to me if you want to talk about what this strategy can look like there. We have a great political power unionism pamphlet, if you stop by our table, that talks about the role of labor in this moment and what it can look like for labor to engage electorally in ways that builds the power of the left. The short version, I would say, is we can't afford to sit this fight out anymore. So if you're in a union or a 501c3 nonprofit or an organization that hasn't engaged with politics in the past and thought you can afford to let that aside, we can't. Figure out, build the infrastructure, get yourself a C4. How can you actually like name and frame and contest in this fight? And for folks who are doing electoral work, particularly in organized labor, how can you do it in ways that doesn't just reproduce the centrist democratic establishment, but actually starts to build a genuine left analysis? How can you build class struggle into the conversations you have on the doors about why to vote for whoever, right? You can do that. And how can you build that in relation with independent political organizations, with other social movement forces, so that we're building a powerful core? Thank you.
Thank you, Bennett. And Ashley, we'll have you close us out for this round. Tell us about how North Star is looking at all of this, and then if you want to speak to some red contexts, maybe the South, if you would.
Whew, yeah, okay. Small lift in a really short amount of time, so hold on. We're about to move really quick. I think what I want to start with is that I come from an organizing tradition that says that by any means necessary means by all the means. And so where we might have difference, we're like, still, please do that excellently, because if we're wrong, don't we all still get socialism if they were right? and there's actually a lot more alignment up here than difference, so I want to start with that. And if you hear difference, that's all it is. It's not the end of the world. We're still friends. And I've been in like most of these organizations. But I want to brag about North Star, in part because I think sometimes we build these organizations and then don't practice what we preach around the things that we're learning and that we're pulling from organizing traditions of the past. Let me start with like theory, practice, and summation, right? It's like we actually have spent months and months and months at a time thinking about and struggling with comrades inside of our formation and outside of our formation about what time it is on the clock of the world right now. And then what the United, what our role as folks within the United States, within the apparatus of the belly of the beast, then must do and be responsible for because of what time it is on the clock of the world. And because of that, we've made some assessments. We've made some assessments that like that United Front stuff that Bennett was just talking about is not subjective. It exists whether you decide to play in it or not. Y'all don't hear me, so let me break it down. There's a United Front that is like pro-fascist, pro-authoritarianism. And it is everybody from like the social and economic conservative class folks to MAGA, right? And MAGA, though maybe not the majority of people in that United Front, have consolidated their power to run it. And even the Republicans that don't like Trump can't really stop it. That is objectively what time it is, whether I like it or not, right? On the flip, there's another United Front that's actually down for democracy. This United Front is huge. It's everybody from like Lincoln Republicans who are like, I'm conservative, but that shit is bad, right? It's like Michael Steele, right? As an example, the black Republican. Don't ask me about that. And so I'm too sober to get into my assessment about him, but like those kinds of Republicans all the way to like black bloc anarchists, right? It's huge. And to Bennett's point, we actually haven't consolidated our power, even in our little factions and fiefdoms, to be able to run that United Front in the same way that MAGA has, right? Neither has corporate Dems. So now we're like in this weird situation where we have to make these fair weather friends to be more powerful than the MAGA faction of that proto-fascist front. Does that make sense? That is true. And if we decide that we're not going to get down in elections, okay, but it's still true, right? So we made a lot of assessments about then what that meant, right? How many of y'all, like in 2020, were like in the defense of Black Lives sort of protest movement? How many of y'all hit the streets? Yeah, a bunch of us. I see you. Thank you. How many of y'all, even if you disagreed with it, were like, defund the police? Yeah, I get it. Unity in action, comrades. We can talk about that over beers or something too. Then how many of you were like, and I still don't like elections? You don't have to lie. It's okay. It's all right. I'm not judging. I just really want to see. So what I would have asked, what I wish I had asked more in that time was like, okay, well, you want to defund the police. Well, who controls budgets? And how do those people that control budgets get into those positions? Is it just like they self-appoint themselves? Is that how it happens? How do they get into the position? They're elected. It's your governor, right? It's your mayor. And then who approves it? Your city council, or like if your country, your county commission or your town council. On the state level, it's whatever you have. If you have a state congress or whatever you call your state's legislative body, right? So if we're not getting in elections, that's basically like saying, give me what I want. But I ain't gonna say nothing about how you got into the position for me to have to demand of you what you want. It's just not logical, comrades. So let's start there. That's Ashley's assessment. That's Ashley's interpretation of North Star's assessment. It's like, be about it. You know what I'm saying? So then what? So then we were like, okay, I think similarly to the road, we were like, okay, we believe that we have to have a cadre organization in this country. We need them. It's actually a piece of the movement apparatus that we need. We probably need more than a lot, right, of cadre organizations that are doing these external facing and internal development work to be able to build the kind of strength of the left that is disciplined and rigorous and emotionally intelligent, right? Let me not skimp on the emotionally intelligent, right? That's a huge cornerstone of North Star's work. It's like, how can we also be intentional about assessing our life conditions so that we can meet people where they are without leaving them where we found them? So we're like, okay, how do we build disciplined comrades that share our strategic orientation? And I left out one really important piece of our strategic orientation. It's like, for us to be, and I said it, but I want to say it explicitly so y'all aren't confused. We believe that in the days where we could have like figured out how to change the material conditions of the working class without capturing the state are over, if they ever existed in the first place. If we could change the material conditions of working class people without the state capturing the state, wouldn't you have done it? Right? So we believe it's our turn to storm the Winter Palace, comrades. And that might take some time, so we're experimenting with how do we build the capacity of our folks to do a multitude of tactics, up to and including electoral justice, to block the right and build the left. We believe that you can do something like elections and do both at the same time. It's not like you block the right and that's electoral and you build the left and that's alternatives. It's like, nah, everything we doing, we testing up against block and build, right? So then we were like, okay, that's our assessment. How do we build a liberatory strategy? And our comrades from Left Roots, give it up one time for Left Roots, or the organization formerly known as, we love the comrades that were involved in that 10-year project, had already come up with a thing that was a toolkit for building liberatory strategy. Take out liberatory, put in revolutionary, that's what they meant, is my assessment. And so we spent some time experimenting with a strategy about what could be done in the U.S. to build that kind of left power and block the MAGA threat. And then we were like, okay, well, that's dope if our like little crew knows that that's what we gonna do. But the social movement left is that, how many people feel like you've been waiting for someone to tell the social movement left what to do in this season? And we all over the fucking place and we fighting with each other like was mentioned, but we not really actually talking to nobody outside of we're organizing organizers, right? So we were like, we got to a point where we were like, we've gotta say, and it might be wrong, and leftists might be mad at us, but we have to say something that helps folks make sense of the errors that could be made in this moment and what we would do if we didn't make those errors. So we wrote something called the Movement Memo. Did anybody read the Movement Memo? Y'all, it's a love letter to the social movement left. Like, I'm not kidding. It was our best thinking at the time about how to share our strategy, our strategic orientation, about how to say, like, these are the things we should absolutely not do. Stuff like saying Kamala and Donald Trump are the same. They are not. That's a lie from the pits of the hell I don't believe in. Right? About not being confused about power, what it is, who's got it, who doesn't, how to build it. And then we spent some time talking about really literally what are the steps that we could do right now to fight. I can't really talk about that right now, in part because this is a C3 space. But if you are interested in some of those things, I'm happy to tell you. But some of it was like, think about the Congress people that you saw fighting for a ceasefire. What should you do for them? Right? What would it look like to actually really be serious about base building? And I don't mean just talking to organizers. What does it mean to like align a movement-centered platform for the first 100 days of the new administration? What does it look like to actually exemplify principled struggle with other leftists out here in the world, right? Instead of it looking like we hate each other and we never agree on anything, what does it look like to actually build solidarity through principled struggle? And what does it look like to flank and support our Arab, Muslim, and Palestinian comrades in this moment? And lastly, but not leastly, join a socialist organization, like be in something that's explicitly socialist, a cadre organization, even if it's not ours, do it and build it excellently. So there's way more in the movement memo that I can't get into for the sake of time, but if you wanna see it, you can go to, if you just Google North Star Organization movement memo, a website will come up that you can then get the PDF of the document with.
Thank you. That wraps up our question. So that's so much amazing good stuff to process. Also, I have many questions. We hope you have questions too. We'd love for you all to now start strategizing with us, right? So we're gonna ask folks to cluster with folks around you in groups of three or four. However you can best do that. You might just want to turn around in your seat or, you know, look at the little quadrants in your area so you don't have to move around too much. And for about 10 minutes, we want to give you a couple questions to ponder. What in this conversation resonated with you? What were your biggest questions coming out of this conversation? And what might you take away back to your organizing bases, your communities from this conversation? As a one exercise, we have some support folks with cards, and we're gonna pass those out. And if you can write your questions down as a group in your clusters, if you have any big questions that you'd like to bring back up to the panelists, we'll ask you to write those down on the cards. If you don't have any questions, questions, that's okay too. But again, the three questions again are: what resonated with you? What are the biggest questions you still have? And what might you take back to your communities from this conversation? So yeah, if just groups of three or four around you, please try and talk to folks you don't know, if at all possible. Oh, sure, please, Monica. All right, folks, if you can come back to the main.
Solid as a rock.
Solid as a rock.
We are rooted like a tree.
We are here.
Standing strong. In our rightful place. We are solid as a rock. We are rooted like a tree.
We are here.
Standing strong. In our rightful place. In our rightful place. In our rightful place. Thank you for coming back.
Okay.
How was it?
Yeah, good.
Oh my gosh, okay. We won't get to all the questions. Unfortunately, we do want to respect everyone's time, but would love to hear from some of you, from some of the reflections that you all had in your group conversations. If anyone would like to raise their hands and share a moment or a comment, Jayani will come to you with the mic.
Those weren't questions, those
are statements. Sorry, we stole your notes.
We'll take three. We'll take three. So I saw a hand. Oh, right here. Yes.
Hello. I'm Chaiki Brion. I'm from Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma, where the 1921 race massacre was. And I just actually left the museum, the Black History. So if you guys have any time to go do that one, it was very emotional. I cried for most of it because that history is so relevant at this point. And I'm glad that you said that people are not seeing like this, how serious it can be. 1983, the mayor here started stuff. I'm talking to some guy from Chicago. He said how easily they were trying to block these things from progressing through him. Nope, we're not gonna let you do it. You won, but we're still not gonna let you do anything. So if that was 83, my mother was four. That's crazy to me on how easy this can still happen again. So when they say make America great again, you ask them what year. What year specifically do you want to go back to? Because that will tell me everything I need to know about your mission. Why I'm here, it's not really a question, but I need people to hear this. I went to a school in Oklahoma, graduated in 2016. People that I graduated with, we are no longer friends because they rather their whiteness be in front of our friendship, as in they would kill me if I stayed in the state. I had people threaten my life that I thought we were friends. These people are very serious about the violence they're willing to inflict on their friends that they went to high school with, their people that are next door to them. How do you think we can combat that if Kamala wins? If she doesn't win and he wins, they're not going to care about the violence. They've already won. They're going to get their, they're going to win their elections. They're going to go. They're going to have fun. We're going to lose. But if she wins, what should we do as a whole? As a community, how do we fastly get that done? Because in my head, all I see is the purge. I live in a Black neighborhood on a dead-end street and I'm the last house. So what do I do?
Hi, I'm Raheem Buford from Tennessee.
Oh, thank
you. All right. Yeah, so this is very difficult for us because of the time constraints, number one. So I do my best to put what we talked about in a way that you can comprehend, and definitely we need you to respond because we have a problem with the accountability factor with the Democratic Party. While you want us to practice a form of solidarity, although we know it's not even real, so the integrity factor there tells us that we are compromising what principles we do believe in to fight against, not for, but against. And then there is a group of us who, and I am formerly incarcerated, that there's a silence, but then we're being used through the Democratic campaign the prosecutor against the felon. So we have personal issues with that. And then we have the international issues where thousands of people are being actually murdered. And we're talking about, so is this democratic election only about Americans, or is it about all of the oppressed, struggling people around the world? Yeah. And so make sure I get it all in. How is the mobilization of this front using our power to make progress for those being thrown under the bus, incarcerated, immigrants, the people being genocided?
All right, in light of time, we're just gonna go into some of, we wanna get to your questions as well. And unfortunately, you see how many beautiful questions are up here. But I think we do see a recurring theme in some of these questions, so I'll give it to the panelists. I think addresses some of these comments. What does forming a united front look like? What are the consequences there in terms of, and potential sacrifices in that formation? And how, what does that mean in a longitudinal way?
Yeah, so this is the hardest question, I think particularly this year. You know, the American empire, you know, is murderous, and that's kind of built into any domestic fights we have, and its murderousness has become palpable and unbearable, even for those of us who are distanced from the conflict. I'm not telling anybody, you know, how they need to vote or what they need to do. I'm telling you my analysis, which is, yes, of course we're compromising. We don't have any power. If we had power, we could be a bigger force in that popular front. But there's no other choice, right? Like, it's either we participate or we don't build power, because the people who have power are going to see that we're absenting ourselves from the field and not listen to us. So it's like, where, you know, the thing about why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. You know, why do I want to contest elections? Because the state's where the power is. And so I get it. Like, I understand why it feels, because it is. It is necessarily a compromise. Someone described it once as, you know, we threw the Popular Front party and the other side didn't show up. Like, you know, I was at the DNC last week with the Not Another Bomb folks, and the demand of the speaker was meant to be the demand that shows you that tests the power, that sees how willing they are. And they didn't, you know, they basically pulled out of negotiations, and they did so because the outside demonstrations weren't that big. Like, that's what the reporting suggests, that just basically, I'm not using insider information, that's what sort of convince them not to give on that point. And so what does that tell me? It tells me we need to make those protests bigger. We need to make the people inside the tent bigger. We need to build more power so next time we're able to move them. And I will say, I thank you to J.D. Vance for making childless women in our late 40s now apparently a target for oppression. It's the first time in my adult life that I'm like, they're coming after me too. But, you know, I have friends who are, you know, if Trump wins, they're going to leave the country. I have friends who feel fearful for their lives in really concrete ways. And I just, you know, and I have friends whose family are in Gaza. And if I thought that we could effectively change what's happening in Palestine by not supporting Harris, I would be completely open to that. I don't think that is a viable strategy. And I think that we have to make our decisions for what is going to be best for the people who are being thrown under the bus, because once we're driving the bus, we won't throw them under the bus. And that means we have to, again, take over that bus. And apologies for like 10 different mixed metaphors.
For
First, before I forget it, I'm sure there are questions we won't get to. If you want to talk more with Liberation Road about those questions, we are tabling all throughout this conference on the ground floor with the tables on the other side. Stop through and talk to us. The good thing about being in a cadre socialist organization is you can ask your questions for me to any of the 10 or so folks from my organization who are here, and they will give you probably a more eloquent and better version of the answer I would have given, because we're in the process of developing shared strategy, right? So come talk to us. You can pick up a copy here of our Block, Broad, and Build paper, which gives more details about the electoral strategy. At our table, you can find prolific resources about all kinds of other things, so come see us. Let's see. Okay, a couple different points. What does accountability look like? One, I think we need to recognize where we have actually won and consolidated our positions within the pro-democracy front and where we have not. There are many actual issue areas where, in the crisis of neoliberalism that is crumbling, the Democratic Party establishment is proving shockingly to fall in the face of our effort to build other things. I mentioned the Green New Deal. You know, for all the limitations of what actually made it through, but the kind of attempt by Biden to restore social welfare spending, to give tax credits to parents, to think about universal pre-K, like, we're actually winning within that front on a variety of issues. And so our goal there is to keep pushing where we're winning, and to, you know, accept that we actually have some power and are doing some good stuff, which is amazing.
I agree.
the places within our front where we are not winning right now, in my opinion, and this is not an organizational position, this is me off the cuff, but the places we are not winning are immigration, mass incarceration, and imperialism, right? We are, by the way, because I mentioned the good news is I think trans rights and immigration are fault lines with the MAGA right now. Despite the silence of Harris and the DNC around trans rights at the convention, which was unfortunate, and I think an electoral calculation, I do actually think we are winning and consolidating around that issue within the Democratic Party. We're seeing that in blue states actually expanding aggressively, like trans-affirming care. So that's a place I think also should recognize where we've been able to win some stuff. But we're not winning right now on immigration, mass incarceration, and imperialism, and I think we need to take seriously what will it look like for us to push on those places where the sort of pro-democracy united front that we're part of is not consolidated around our position. I am deeply worried about the rightward drift of the Democratic Party establishment around immigration that is now putting forward policies that are light years to the right of where Obama was in 2008, you know. Same thing on mass incarceration, right? You know, in the aftermath of 2020 George Floyd uprisings and pushback, I think a significant part of the Democratic Party establishment decided that they had to abandon any attempts to really deeply address that issue. And again, we can talk about whether defund is the right slogan. There's all kinds of questions about tactics and strategy, but we need to be pushing forward on that. Imperialism is the tough... So before I say this, our comrades at North Star brilliantly said we need to be coming up with what are our 3 to 5 things that we're going to push on day one of a Harris administration. We've said we're in a process of unity struggle with centrist Democrats. Let's unite in November, and the day after that election, let's start struggling again. So, and, you know, I guess my proposal off the cuff for 3 of our issues is immigration, mass incarceration, and imperialism, I think, are places we should be pushing. We should also think about not just where we're weak, but where are we strong, and where can we be pushing where we have consolidated buy-in with the Democratic Party to actually advance that agenda and implement transformative policies around living wages, around reproductive care, around K-12 stuff. But the tricky thing is going to be figuring out how do we figure out what do we fight for first. Around imperialism, it's the deepest part of the U.S. state project. It is deeply embedded in that project on both sides of the aisle and across both the neoliberal consensus period and the neo-Keynesian period that preceded it, right? So we have to understand that this is a long-term struggle to change what is a deeply embedded part of the state. And to build the power to do it, we have to be building and advancing at all levels in order to have the power to deeply, fundamentally transform the foreign policy of the United States such that it is no longer arming genocidal regimes, imposing sanctions on countries like Venezuela that cripple their ability to have autonomy and self-determination. That's not a refutation of our inside-outside strategy. That is the culmination of what will happen if we are successful at being able to do it. In the meantime, the genocide in Gaza is unacceptable and it has to stop now. And it is devastating that we have not been able to stop it yet. I think a few things I will say that give me, I hope isn't even the right word for it, but that I think are possibilities and openings. One, despite the egregious failure of the DNC not to even give a speaker to talk about Palestine from the stage, a huge strategic mistake, and a shout out to the brilliant organizing of the uncommitted folks for polarizing around that. For choosing a common sense demand that actually won more people to our position, even people who aren't yet on board fully with the need for liberation of Palestine, we're like, well, surely they should have a speaker. I mean, it was a brilliant move that won more people to our positions. And we saw that in the fact that the lines calling for a ceasefire in Gaza had some of the biggest applause of anything that happened at the DNC. And so the Harris administration may not have made that change. They might not have realized this. But the vast majority of the Democratic electorate has shifted and it supports a ceasefire. The majority of the country supports a ceasefire, a majority of independents, 75 or 80% of people under 30. The ground has shifted. And the folks clapping inside the DNC are the folks on the inside of that inside strategy. This is your local party officials, your local elections. So it is shifting and it will continue to shift. And it is devastating that with every day that has not changed, we are seeing a cost of human lives. But I do believe that it is untenable for even the centrist, neoliberal establishment Democrats to hold onto this position because they have lost the social base to support it. The last thing I'll say is we didn't get to talk about global right-wing authoritarianism, but what's happening here with MAGA is part and parcel of global trends. And Renee mentioned that, unfortunately, in this moment, the left is not as strong as it has been in other historical periods. That is unfortunately also, by and large, and with some exceptions, a global trend. with inspiring examples like the wonderful victory of the French New Popular Front, which gives us lessons also about those struggles with centrists, you know. I have no doubt that we will be in a better position to build a global international left, which is a crucial task, on a terrain in which we don't have the MAGA right in power, building and deepening alliances with other right authoritarian regimes in foreign countries. And I really beg of folks, there's a tendency on the US left to think that any enemy of an enemy is a friend. So if we're opposed to US imperialism, then any ruling class or government that opposes the US must be something we should support. Stop it. Stop doing that. Like, it's just wrong. And in the name of that, we end up supporting regimes like Iran, for the Iranian regime was, you know, suppressing people. So my plea is, like, let's actually be able to think through evaluating what struggles look like in other places, not be so blinkered and focused on America that we don't do that, and talk to people in other parts of the world and in other countries. I'm thinking of my friend Naveed, shout out to you, in Iran, who's like driving this home. It's like, how do we actually build a genuine international solidarity that understands that unfortunately right now, many regimes in the world, even those that oppose the US, are actually not our class allies, they are our class enemies. Thanks.
We're at time, so Ashley, take us home.
I'm going to take us home, and I'm going to be quick, but I'm going to take my time too, okay? Yeah, where to start? I feel like the left dies a slow death of 1,000 bad sound bites. And I might have a few bad sound bites that I'm about to share with you right now, but I'm asking you to actually hold DSA, Liberation Road, and North Star accountable to being bigger than a sound bite. And so, even though I'm going to say some things that might be tweetable,
actually out of context, it's not going to be what I'm trying to say. Okay. So like, stay with me through this journey. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I think there's a piece of United Front building that I think folks think is just supposed to feel good. Like team, like a team building exercise, like coalition building. And I'm not saying that can't be true. I think there, for, I had a lot of folks that were like friends of mine, comrades of mine, that were inside trying to see what the hell was going on at the DNC. And there were moments that were absolutely disheartening and disgusting and dehumanizing. And there were moments where, to Bennett's point, stuff happened and we were like, oh shit, we didn't know they was down for this. Like, oh, wait a minute. The base maybe actually understands. And some of those working class people, frankly, who we as the left have conceded to the right and to centrists, were also in that room. And then when they heard us, they were like, oh, yeah, that. We want that. Whether it happened from the stage or not. But the idea that it has to feel good or make you feel excited is liberal. Oh, Jesus. And it's not, to me, I think your question is absolutely the right one. Because I think it's not actually about building inside the United Front just so that the liberals and us win. That's this much of it. The rest of my every fucking day is trying to build a left that's strong enough to not have to be in that relationship ever again, right? So if we prioritize one over the other, we still lose. Let me tell you how I know. Because in 2020, we had 27 million people in the streets, and then as soon as the motherfuckers won, they cut us out. We've done it already. We've seen the consequence. Whew, okay, all right. But the idea that we're powerless, which I know was hyperbole, is bullshit too. The abdication of responsibility is ridiculous. To tell people, okay, I can agree with you that Trump and Kamala aren't the same, but you know, then you just choose what you want to do. Choose your own adventure is irresponsible. So I want to just sit in the uncomfortable place that we are in, where we have lots of choice. We have infinite numbers of choices that we as individuals and as organizations, as communities can make in this season. And 99% of them are choosing bad to bad choices, right? And some of that is because we inherited some shit. You've already heard the history of how we got here. Some of this is systemic. And some of this is because we actually have, we prioritized other things as the left, right? So what does it look like to have to make, like, decide between bad choices that all are consequential because there is no neutrality, while also navigating that we're still building enough power, to Renee's point, to actually not be in these conditions ever again? It's tricky, and we're gonna mess up, right? So what does accountability look like to me with the Dems? I can talk to you about accountability. What it looks like to me is like Cori Bush. Cori not only ran an impossible campaign, lost multiple times before we finally got her to Congress, right? Then the second she got in there, guess what she did? She did a hunger strike that won you some shit, right? Guess what else she did? She put forward a bill that the Movement for Black Lives wrote that people told us was impossible to win, right? Y'all know the People's Response Act is literally a fourth of the BREATHE Act, right? We did that in 2020. Y'all did that. So what accountability looks like is being not in a codependent relationship with corporate Dems. And it looks like using the party apparatus as much as we can or have to in this moment so that we can actually break the back of the two-party system, which if we didn't learn anything from the DNC is that people are over the two-party system. Shout out to the Working Families Party. Last couple of things. Uncommitted. Let's just go there. The demand for the speaker was a tactic. It was not the goal. And if you really think that these Palestinians were dumb enough to ever believe that it was going to be easy or even possible to get a speaker at the DNC stage, you don't know them. But let me tell you what happened. In the last 10 days from August 27th, broadcast TV mentions of uncommitted and or Palestinian American speaker at the convention reached predominantly Democratic voters over 45. Who frequently watch those stations. With a 30-second ad on CNN or MSNBC during the DNC costing around $20,000, we can crudely estimate that uncommitted generated $20.4 million in earned media coverage on those two networks alone. Right?
CNN mentioned them 558 times. MSNBC mentioned them 433 times. Detroit local TV mentioned them 1,121 times. ABC, NBC, and CBS had 280 mentions. And the DC NPR station had 385 mentions, right? And every single one of those mentions, uncommitted people were saying ceasefire. Uncommitted people were saying arms embargo, right? So y'all majoring in the minor and flunking the major of what we won, right? Biden not running for president is evidence that we held the Democratic National Committee accountable. Shout out to Palestinians. Shout out to Black people who have been campaigning against him since the 90s. I ain't never been excited about Joe Biden, right? And how we hold them accountable, how we hold, like, you know, I'm from Tennessee. We got a right-wing trifecta. And for the little bit of local Democrats that we got, they mostly corporate Dems. You're absolutely right. Right? How I can hold them accountable is building the power to unseat them. I ain't trying to argue with these fools while they actually are in here legislating, making concessions every day. I think to Renee's point, it's like we have no idea what it's like when they get in those positions. Right? So how I hold them accountable is having the power to unseat them. Our concessions... It's allowing for other people to fill the vacuum that's missing when our leadership isn't there. And political violence, I don't know where the comrade is that asked about that. Political violence is happening from the Democrats just as much as it's happening from the right wing too. Like it's gonna happen either way. I think that assessment is right. And the way that I think we can combat it, the way that we can actually prioritize building the left and not just blocking MAGA is by not just being pundits, but being protagonists. Now's the time we've got to get to doing something. And we might not have alignment on every single bit of that, but as long as we can test it around blocking and building, right, then we might actually all end up in the place, a little bit closer to the place where the arguments that we're having are creating different mistakes for us to be making as a left.
Thank you. All right. And with that, we're going to close out our session, but I think we have one last song that we're
going to sing. Can I make an announcement?
Oh,
just
of course.
Because people will kill me if I don't. So one Socialist Majority is, along with our comrades in the Groundwork Caucus, we have a launch call this week for Socialism Beats Fascism, which is our program around the 2024 election. And because we're in the C3 space, I won't say more. And then we're also hosting a social tonight that everyone is welcome at 9 p.m. tonight at the Off Color Brewery on Kingsbury Street. So that's Off Color Brewing. At 9. Thank you.
All right, we're going to fly through this. Everybody stand. Also going to remind you that North Star's having an informal social tomorrow. If you want the flyer, come get it. It also has a QR code to the movement memo, and you'll see a lot of these people there. All right, so we're going to do this in a way that all of my elders would be pissed at me for doing, but we're going to fly through it. Everybody on from this beautiful pink shirt, so like split this row in half. Everybody closest to the wall. Y'all are going to go, we are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. Can y'all do that? We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. Do it again. We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. Do it again. We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. Y'all got it? All right. Everybody from the middle, y'all are going to go, we are the ones we've been waiting for. Can you do that?
We are the ones we've been waiting for.
Then you're going to go, we are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Now put it together. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Okay. We are the ones. We are the ones. We've been waiting. Keep going. We are the ones. We are the ones. We've been waiting. Here y'all go. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Keep going. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Everybody else. We are the ones We've been waiting. We are the ones. We've been waiting. Keep going. We are the ones. We've been waiting. We are the ones. I want you to sing it like you believe it as we close it out. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Love y'all.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.